Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. This is the second half of an interview with Wesley J. Smith on transhumanism and bioethics. The first half of the interview can be heard at changesurfer.com. In this part of the conversation, we're talking about the contradiction between individual rights and property rights.
Well, the commodification of biology is actually an independent question from what rights we give to people. In fact, the two may be in obverse relation. In other words, if I have, as a person, I have a right to control my body, it may be that no one should be able to claim a genetic patent on any part of my body, that only I should be able to control the genetic property of my body. So it may be that granting people rights is actually going to screw up the system of patent law. But let me take you one more place, which is you mentioned animal rights. So we've touched on personhood theory, your problemhood with that. We've touched on transhumanism, which is you're worried that if we create post-humans that it's going to somehow screw up the rights that we give to other humans. Your problem with animal rights, you know about the Great Ape Project that Peter Singer's involved with. The Great Ape Project proposes that we extend to great apes the rights that you see as essential for humans, that they shouldn't be experimented on without their permission, which, of course, they can't give.
Period, yeah.
Yeah, and that they shouldn't be killed unnecessarily, et cetera, et cetera. And that has absolutely, the people who are involved in the Great Ape Project have said nothing about whether human beings should be treated any differently, only to the extent that if we start treating monkeys better, we might treat each other better.
Well,
why don't you buy that
that's
argument?
Not true about Peter Singer. I'm sorry. You know,
well, Peter Singer has a more complicated set of arguments, but the Great Ape Project involves people who want to treat apes better.
Well,
and they have said nothing about how we treat human beings, except that we might treat human beings better if we treat monkeys better.
Well, what happens when, as we now know or suspect, that AIDS and HIV comes from chimpanzees, but chimpanzees don't get ill from it? Should we not be allowed to experiment on chimpanzees to try to make it so that humans can either not get ill from it or can be cured of that horrible disease? I say yes. Under the Great Ape Project, the answer is no. So what you end up doing with the Great Ape Project in certain circumstances is perpetuating or increasing or failing to alleviate human suffering, which should be our first priority, certainly not our only priority, but our first priority. I believe in an animal welfare approach, which looks to not only the suffering caused by animals, but the benefit to humans, and which also posits a human obligation based on human dignity and our empathy and our understanding of what it means to suffer, to try to obtain those human benefits with the least amount of suffering as possible. And that's certainly something that is incredibly human. But to say that animals, apes, elephants, or any animal, should be a person equal to a human is misanthropic, because you are saying that we are not special, we are just other animals in the forest, and I submit that it won't be so much that we'll treat some animals better, I think we'll end up treating some people worse.
Is there no form of life, no form of consciousness, say for instance, a chimpanzee who'd been genetically engineered to have the capacity of speech and to reason as well as a human being, is there no circumstance under which you would recognize that a non-human form of consciousness could be granted permission to enter our polity and participate as an equal with humans?
I don't know the answer to that question, to be frank with you. But I do think that the arguments over that should be completely excluded from how we treat people. In other words, if we're going to decide how animals are to be treated, and I think that's a legitimate and very worthy issue for discourse and for determination, we have to take humans out of the equation. What many animal rightists do is say, for example, well, if we're going to use an animal that has a higher cognitive capacity than a disabled person for research that is to benefit humans, we should not use the animal, we should use the human. And that is often stated by many in animal rights, although most in animal rights say we shouldn't be able to use animals for research at all, as opposed to animal welfare. PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, as you know, say we shouldn't be able to eat them, we shouldn't be able to wear leather, we shouldn't be able to use them in medical experiments, regardless of the human cost that that would entail. But if we have, like, I'm often asked, well, what if an alien comes? You know, how will we decide whether the alien has benefits? Well, you know, we'll deal with that when it comes. My joke is we'll have to worry about them caring about us because they'll be more advanced than us. But these discussions...
But the reason people ask you, Wesley, is because it sounds to us like you are simply a rank anthropocentrist.
Well, I am an anthropocentrist in that sense, but I'm saying that these discussions, you have to take humans out of it, that humans as a species have to be dealt with as a whole, not as individuals, because then none of this is safe. If today I walk out of, after this interview, out of into the backyard and there's this big walnut tree in the neighbor's yard and a branch falls on my head and I become cognitively disabled, I want to be valued just as highly then as I am now.
Okay, most transhumanists have never given any thought to taking away the rights of anyone. They simply want the right to genetically engineer themselves, and most transhumanists aren't terribly interested about reproducing themselves either, unfortunately, since I happen to be a parent. But what most of them are concerned about is genetically engineering themselves to live longer and be smarter,
well,
and have more
that's
abilities.
That's not what I'm, you know.
Okay. So do you have any problem with that, with the creation of new categories of post-humanity, as long as it doesn't influence the values of everybody else?
Well, this idea of post-humanity causes me a lot of concern, because then you could get into the concept of Ubermenschen and master race kind of thinking. So I'd have to see what you're talking about. If somebody is going to, for example, if you get a prosthesis, right, if you've lost an arm, now, in a sense, that's enhancement. But, of course, I have no objections to that. If I have to wear glasses in a form that's enhancement, there is now something called laser surgery, which I'm not going to get because I don't want to risk it. And I think I look better with glasses. I've been wearing them so long. But if I wanted laser surgery so I no longer needed glasses, that's not changing my nature. That may be improving my capacities to be able to see better. I have no objection to that. But there comes a point where, instead of having as a tool to make me function better, you're beginning to change the nature of the person. So when you talk about, as you do, I mean, some of this sounds very futuristic, and it is, but the idea of people melding their consciousnesses into several, you know, you can explain it better than I am. I've just read what you've written. But the idea of group identities and downloading into computers and this kind of thing, the Raelians, who I have debated, I debated Brigitte Bousier at the University of Alabama. My understanding of what the Raelians want and the reason they're in favor of human cloning is they think that they're materialists. They're often called a religious cult. I think they're a science cult because they're materialists. They don't believe in evolution. They believe that aliens came here and created all life on the planet through cloning processes and so forth. But that their road to immortality, they say, is to clone themselves and then download their minds into the clones successively. I'm a big fan of Star Trek, Deep Space Nine. I don't know if you watched it, but there was a great character called Wyoon, who was one of the great bad guys on the show. And every time Wyoon would be killed, his clone would be back with all knowledge that, you know, occurred to the previous Wyoons.
Right.
That was a fun character, and I enjoyed that, but I think the Raelians are taking that quite seriously. So I think that, I guess what I'm, again, taking a little too long to say is we have to distinguish between something that is, let's say, a tool for you to perform better versus changing nature.
Okay. I guess the nub of my disagreement with the article, the argument that you lay out, is not that that these different trends, certain versions of animal rights, certainly not all, but certain versions, personhood theory, and some versions of transhumanism, not that they don't raise the question of whether there should be a readjustment of the types of rights that are granted to different kinds of beings, but rather that they necessitate any readjustment. In other words, I think you could have the current apportionment of rights to different human beings in different statuses stay exactly the same, raise the rights that we grant to certain kinds of animals, such as, for instance, chimpanzees and apes, and allow human beings the right to transform themselves and perhaps their progeny to become, to live longer, to have green skin, whatever things transhumanists want to do. And those things could be part of that greater human family as well.
Have you considered what will happen to cohesive society if we get to the places, one of the articles I read had, that post-humans were so different from humans that they wouldn't even be able to procreate together anymore? What, you know, we could become a centrifuge that just, everything just splatters out into a lack of cohesion, and you can have tremendous disintegration.
Do you think that the reason that we give Chinese equal rights in the United States is because Anglos can procreate with them? I don't think that the ability to procreate with things is really the defining characteristic of whether they should have rights
or not. That's avoiding my question.
It's the answer to your question.
Race, as we know, is really not real. Humans, you can't cross pigs with cows, but you can cross Chinese with African or with the black folk, because we're all the same.
The ability to procreate has nothing to do with rights.
But you're talking about something much more than that. And I'm saying I haven't seen, and I certainly have not read all the transhumanist literature out there, but I haven't seen any thought given to the consequences of a society where people have such a lack of commonality, where the only real, as I'm looking at it, perhaps the only isn't the right word, but the substantial agreed upon ethos is that there will be nothing other than what the person wants to do. And you could end up with such a polyglot society, and I'm not talking about language, that the cohesion completely falls apart.
Well, we have given substantial thought to that. If you look at the use of the term transhumanism in the works of Bruce Sterling, such as in his Schismatrix novels, and of course the interplay and the boundaries between science fiction and transhumanist writing are kind of porous. But at any rate, that is in fact the meaning of transhumanism in his book, is the movement, the political movement to create and establish a common civic mindedness and a polity that includes both humans and post-humans of all varieties. And for me, and that is a central part of this movement for me as well, for me, one of the central questions is, what is of value in life? What is it that we want to protect about life? And for me, the answer is consciousness, that consciousness is the gift that the universe has given us, and it is the gift that we need to perpetuate and appreciate by doing our best to raise it in every form that we find it. You, on the other hand, seem to think it's human DNA which has given us value. And those two views, that consciousness is of value and that human DNA is of value, will, as you point out, I think, come into inevitable conflict.
Right. I wouldn't say it's human DNA, but I do think being human, if we're to enjoy equal rights, which is what we've been striving for a long time now, is universal human equality. And it strikes me that the threat to that, just as we are getting rid of racism and sexism and things of that sort, which I, of course, support, we're now saying we're going to find other ways to discriminate against certain humans. So what I see happening, and I'm not saying this is the intent, but I think it's the effect, is that you're just going to create new forms of discrimination, but you'll have different victims, and those would be the people who have less cognitive capacity. You know, one of the best people I ever met, Jim, was a developmentally disabled man named Davey, who I took care of for 3 years. He was my former brother-in-law. Davey's died, but he had a significant mental retardation. He had grand mal seizures, and he was one of the most sweet, gentle, kind, forgiving, wanting to be helpful humans I've ever met. If the rest of the world was like Davey,
I hear this argument a lot that disabled people are all wonderful and have wonderful abilities.
Wonderful, well, I'm just saying, Davey is the kind of person who would be, you know, basically wiped out of the.
I hear this argument a lot. What percentage of the population, if we had the ability to screen and to make sure that there was no congenitally mentally retarded people in the next generation of humanity, what percentage would you think we should ideally have?
I don't think that we should create. I think we should allow nature to take its course.
Well, that gives over to if you're a religious conservative, I understand where that comes from. God sends retarded people to us for a reason. We have to accept whatever God gives. If you are, on the other hand, a public health advocate or someone who believes in the capacity of society to rationally determine its own affairs, I think it's the ideal answer. The obvious answer is the fewest number of retarded people, as possible, because there's something about having a fully functioning human brain which is of value, and which all parents seem to choose for their children when given, almost all parents seem to choose for their children when given an opportunity. Now, the transhumanists are not for any kind of public coercion, for the most part. They are only for people having the right to make this decision. And it's precisely people like yourself and the disability rights movement who say, no, you shouldn't be allowed to determine that you not have disabled children, because you should be forced by the state to take whatever chance sends you.
Well, no, I don't think that's quite right. What I'm saying is that every one of us, however we come, should be as appreciated and equal with the rest of us. And I'm also saying that, and I think there's great benefit to this, that people like Davy, I used to wonder, how could somebody like Davy,
if you could fix Davy, would you fix him? If you could fix him, would you fix him? If you could make him have a normal intelligence, would you? Is his retardation what you value about Davy? Is it that you like having a human pet? You see, when we talk about...
That's really unfair.
Well, when we talk about human dignity, all the people...
He was not a pet. He had great dignity. He was not a pet.
Okay, when we talk about human dignity, the notion that there's somehow an inherent value in having someone who has to be a ward and a dependent strikes me as peculiar.
Yeah, but you know, that's part of what makes us so special as a race. We take care of our weak. We take care of our vulnerable. I would take one of Davy's greatest treats was to go to the grocery store. I bought him a hat, a kind of a jaunty hat. We got him out of a mental institution where he was treated abominably. And we take him to the grocery store. He was thrilled. And I watched people react to Davy. Their faces would light up. They would talk to him. And I was watching people, and this is maybe a little metaphysical for you, but I was watching people, I thought, plant seeds of unconditional love. They were loving Davy and reaching out to Davy and being gracious and friendly and kind to Davy without any thought of return.
So that's why God sends us. That's why God sends us retarded people.
That's what the idea of everything is rational misses. There's more to life.
Are you saying that God sends us retarded people to make us all happy?
No, of course not.
Okay. Would you have fixed Davy if you could have? If you could have given him a pill?
I probably would have, yeah.
Okay, then there's nothing inherently valuable about his being retarded, and maybe he could have brought people happiness in their lives not being retarded.
But there was something inherently valuable about Davy retarded. That's the point I'm making.
Davy, as a person, was inherently valuable, but his retardation was a problem that if we can fix, we should. It's precisely why we don't allow parents to whack their kids in the head with bricks, because we feel that kids who don't have brain damage are better than kids who do have brain damage.
I'm not one of the disability rights advocates who say it is somehow wrong to give somebody a cochlear implant so they can hear.
Glad to hear.
I quite agree with you. And in fact, one of the things we worked really hard on at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute was to get his medication proper so he had far fewer grand mal seizures. The point I'm making is that where I think bioethics is going wrong, and certainly transhumanism, is that you begin to look on people like Davy as having no value or very little value, and start saying they are not persons and they do not have the same rights as other persons, and I'm talking about the basic rights such as life and bodily integrity. There are people out there who are part of the bioethics movement who would have seen Davy, because he was self-aware over time, but many would say he was not a person, who would say that, you know, his life was of less value than my life, and therefore we should be able to do things to him that we couldn't do to me, and that's where I object.
I don't know of any bioethicist who's ever said that about the retarded. The only thing the bioethicists say is that if a person is so cognitively disabled that they have no sense of personhood over time, that they no longer are part of the human family.
Well, I've seen people like Peter Singer say that if a Down syndrome child is born, that child should be allowed to be infanticized.
In the state of infancy.
Right.
Because in the state of infancy, you have a different...
Persons.
They're not a person.
Exactly
then.
My problem. So persons, then infants, newborn infants, become endangered by this theory, and it doesn't matter whether they...
It doesn't matter whether they're retarded or not.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's my point.
Yes, that's right.
That's my point.
Infancy.
All along.
Well, let's come back to infancy. Yes. When we have extrauterine gestation, we will be faced with the decision of when to decant children,
What do you mean by decant?
To take them out of the extrauterine gestation device, whatever it is.
This vocabulary is driving me crazy.
Okay. Yeah. So we have some kind of...
We're going to decant children now instead of give birth to them. Okay.
Well, you know, for those who have them in this device, I'm saying if we're going to separate the question of when you are allowed to terminate the life of this developing fetus, embryo, whatever, from it being inside a human woman, then we're going to get to that point some point. We're going to have them in these machines, and the question will be, at what point are you allowed to destroy it?
Perhaps at no point, because at that point, you're not forcing a woman to do with her body that which she does not wish to do.
And if right-to-lifers,
well, let me finish.
And if Catholic right-to-lifers control our future, then yes.
Well, no one's forcing this embryo and fetus to be created, but once they're created, does human life have ultimate value simply because it's human? If the answer to that is yes, then I think we can go forward into the future protecting universal human equality. But if the answer is no, then some of us are going to be opted out. And I don't see any reason...
If the answer is yes, in vitro fertilization is impossible because we always create extra embryos that we are then destroyed.
That is towards... And that's what I said. I think we've gone as far as we can go. Those embryos are being created for the purpose of bringing a baby into the world. And, of course, in nature, some embryos don't make it. But when you cross a certain line and you're now saying we can then decide to experiment on these embryos and fetuses, I mean, I don't see why not fetuses. A lot of people are saying we should wait only for the first 14 days, but that makes no sense on a personhood basis because a two-month gestated fetus has no more rights or value in a personhood analysis than does a 10-day-old embryo. Would you agree with that?
On a personhood basis, yes. The distinction would be for me between before third trimester and after third trimester.
And the third trimester is because you're beginning to get the
sensation.
Brain waves and so forth.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is taking some forms of human life, and now we're talking about the fetus or the embryo that is in an artificial womb. I don't see any reason to be able to destroy that because I don't accept personhood theory as the value of life. The abortion issue has to do with a conflict between the rights of the fetus embryo and the rights of the woman to bodily integrity, and society has decided which way that's going to go.
And if we could get those pesky women out of the way, then every two-celled human being should have rights.
Well, it seems to me that once you've created human life and you have an embryo, that you should not be able to experiment on it, and you should not be able to just use it as a thing. And I think there should be some very real care taken at that level. I don't see any reason to permit that kind of commodification of human life.
Well, how about, for instance, if we're trying to eradicate disease and allow people to live a lot longer, and we need to use embryos up to a 36-cell stage in order to do that experimentation,
living fetuses at 4 months.
Well, you can take me there, and I'm not unwilling
to
go.
We're talking about the same thing.
I'm not unwilling to go there. Okay, let's say embryos up to 4 months.
Yeah.
Would you use a 4-month embryo for the purpose of doing research that will have important results for humanity? You're saying that we can take a fully alive chimpanzee. You have no problem with taking a fully alive chimpanzee that's sitting there pleading with you not to do anything to it, but to take an embryo.
Aren't you anthropomorphizing yourself there?
No, I'm respecting the personhood and the sensate consciousness of other beings, and that I think is the essential definition for me of human dignity. That if you can look into another being's eyes and recognize that it's looking back at you and that it has that kind of self that you have, that is human dignity. Not to look at some fish-like being which happens to be made from human DNA, which has none of that capacity to look back at you and pretend that that's human. That is not the essential.
You're pretending a chimp is human, but in terms of taking care of experimenting on the chimps, I think you can create criteria, and I believe that a chimp should be less experimented on than a mouse, based on some of the very criteria you talked about. But as I said, there has to be a firewall between how we treat humans, and I do think that in compelling cases, chimps should be able to be experimented on. So should all great apes. So should, if necessary, any other animal, assuming a sufficient human good from that and everything we can do to prevent suffering.
But no embryo.
I don't believe, because a chimp is intelligent.
But no embryo.
The equivalent of a person. I don't believe we should experiment on human life in that fashion, because I think not only would it affect the embryo and the fetus, but in a consequentialist view, it would begin to affect, as we've discussed, newborn infants.
No matter what the benefits, and so forth. We should never do any research on even a one-celled human life, no matter what the benefit.
That would be, I'm not willing to quite be that absolutist, but I think that the general standard should be we don't treat human life as a commodity.
Okay, well, this is a conversation we're going to have to continue. I hope you...
I think it's one of the most and most important conversations we can have.
I absolutely agree.
And I think that the one thing that needs to be recognized is that both sides in this very important debate, which I'm afraid most of society isn't aware of, have good faith and want to do what's best for all of us to the best potential possible. We have very different principles, I think, and value systems, and we have different visions of what the transhumanist future would actually lead to. I think you're very utopian in your outlook, and I think, as with most and if not all utopian enterprises, it ends in tragedy and conflagration. I think utopianism is, it's not religion that causes us problems or ideology so much as utopianism, because eventually, in order to justify getting heaven on earth, to use a phrase, a lot of things can be justified to try to get that incredible good that caused tremendous harm. And I think, especially personhood theory, as we've discussed with newborn infants and others, you see tremendous potential for human harm. And the same thing is true as if we bring animals into the same category of life as humans.
I've been speaking with Wesley Smith. He's the co-author of four books with Ralph Nader, including No Contest, Corporate Lawyers, and the Perversion of Justice in America. He wrote The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, which annoyed a lot of the medical ethicists that I know.
to say the least.
Yeah. He's also the author of Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, and he's currently writing a book about the unholy convergence of transhumanism, animal rights, and a number of other cultural trends. You can read a small piece of that in the National Review online, the article Transhumanists, the Next Great Threat to Human Dignity. Thanks for joining us today, Wesley. I'm sure that you will be back.
I would look forward to it, and I enjoyed our conversation.
This has been the second half of an interview with Wesley J. Smith on transhumanism and bioethics. You can listen to the first half of the interview at changesurfer.com.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.